Good morning.
Morning.
Well, it's a beautiful day here in the Twin Cities. It's not raining, which is probably good. My heart goes out to everyone who's had problems with flooding recently. It's been pretty serious in Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, South Dakota. I know it's caused a lot of problems. So, my heart goes out to you. So, the title of my talk this morning is Which Bodhisattva Does the World Need Most Now? And I've been thinking about the subject matter of this talk for really quite a long time, but I haven't known how to approach it. And when I heard Rosemary's talk last week about the bodhisattvas, that kind of gave me an opening. Sometimes you need kind of a hook, to make it all work. So Rosemary talked last week about bodhisattvas. How many of you heard that talk? Okay, quite a few people. She sat here and she had some statues here. A bodhisattva, to quote Tigan Dan Leighton in his book Faces of Compassion, a bodhisattva carrying out the work of Buddhas vows not to personally settle into salvation of final Buddhahood until she or he can assist all beings throughout the vast reaches of time and space to fully realize this liberated experience. So there are some famous and archetypal bodhisattvas, but we too can be bodhisattvas. He also says, as soon as we are struck with our own urge or intention to take on such a bodhisattva practice, we also are included in the ranks of the bodhisattvas. So Rosemary named five specific bodhisattvas, which are exemplars of how we can be. She named five who each have their own approach to ending suffering: Avalokiteshvara or Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva of great compassion, the hearer of the cries of the world. Also, Jizo, who is a protector of women and children and who goes into the hell realms to help people who are stuck there and bring them out. And Samantabhadra, who's the Bodhisattva of organized activity to relieve suffering. And Maitreya, the Buddha of the future, and Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, who is often portrayed with a sword and he cuts through the cuts through delusion with his sword. So during the question and answer period, which was really good, I thought I had a burning question and I didn't ask it, because people hear from me all the time, and I wanted to give room for some other voices. But here was my burning question: which of these five bodhisattvas does the world most need right now? And that question brings together for me some things that have been on my mind a lot for some time. Because as we go about our daily lives and we take care of our immediate concerns, I think we probably all have, at least in the back of our minds, this ongoing question of just how it is we are going to respond to the cries of the world, to the great problems of the world. So, in my talk today, I'm not going to focus on what the problems of our world are. I'm going to focus on our response to them, how we can prepare ourselves to respond. Suffice it to say, we all have our personal issues that we need to deal with at one time or another. Everyone at some time faces health difficulties or aging or difficulties faced by family and friends. And these things may become very large. They may seem to sort of block everything out. And we have to ask, how are we going to rise to the occasion and take care of these things? And of course, we have the great difficulties of our society at large. We all know about them. We have climate change, we have racial and other disparities. We have the war in Gaza. We have the political situation in the United States, which I think everyone agrees is kind of a crisis, although they might disagree on what the nature of that crisis is. And I've hesitated about whether to talk about our response to these things, because it can be really hard to do. And sometimes we just want kind of a refuge from our problems. But I also feel a sense of responsibility, and I try to go toward the difficult issues. That's what I do. That's my job. That's why you're here. So, kind of a surprising thing to me, and I want to say this just as gently as I can, because I don't want to bring any kind of judgment into this, because it's not helpful at all. But it's kind of a surprising thing to me that I haven't heard people talking so much recently about these difficulties and our responses to them. It seems like people are maybe a little quiet, maybe even a little numb. And I'm not sure why that is. I think for some of us, maybe we just don't have the emotional bandwidth right now. And I felt that in myself sometimes, like I just can't deal with that today. Kind of worn down. And for some, maybe there's a sense of kind of powerlessness in the face of great forces. Or maybe it's just that the time is not right. We're just not ready. We're taking a rest. And sometimes rest is needed. But I think we all know that it can't be a permanent rest. No matter what our situation is, we are going to be called upon to respond to the conditions of our lives. And we can't check out. And that's where my sense of responsibility kicks in. And I also have a sense of opportunity about this, because our practice and our community are designed, are set up to deal with this very thing, to face the most difficult issues in a supportive environment. So this is a talk for folks who are feeling maybe a little bit of discouragement, or a little numbness, or a kind of paralysis. Certainly that doesn't describe all of us. I know some of us, some folks are just like in the thick of it, really in the thick of it. And, but it does apply to some of us. And even those of us who are in the thick of it probably feel a little of this sometimes, need a little recharge. So let's talk about what to do. So the question is, when things are a little difficult, or even when things seem to be at their lowest point, what can we do? What can we do that's not overwhelming, but is not checking out? And again, I want to say this as gently as possible. I'm not saying we have to do this whole thing this morning. I want to gently suggest the possibility of getting started, of fixing to begin to think about doing this thing that needs to be done. So this talk is not about how to decide on specific actions in response to conditions in the world. It's about how to do the inner work that will enable us to approach and embrace the question of what we do in response to the cries of suffering in the world. And where do we look? I would like to look to the most basic Buddhist teaching of all, which is the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha devoted his entire being to ending human suffering. And he often compared himself to a doctor, and the Four Noble Truths is his prescription for ending suffering. And the first noble truth is that suffering exists. We begin with acknowledging it. And how does that apply to our question for the morning? Because remember, our present question is not about acknowledging all the suffering in the world. It's about acknowledging our own suffering that prevents us from being present with all the suffering in the world. What we can do is we can touch our suffering, our own discouragement, our own paralysis. We can just touch it. We don't have to go all the way into it. These are tough times and we need to be gentle. We go in further when we're ready. And the phrase touch our suffering comes from Thich Nhat Hanh. And I'd like to read just one paragraph from his book, The Heart of the Buddha's Teaching. Recognizing and identifying our suffering is like the work of a doctor diagnosing an illness. He or she says, if I press here, does it hurt? And we say, yes, this is my suffering. This has come to be. The wounds in our heart become the object of our meditation. We show them to our doctor and we show them to the Buddha, which means we show them to ourselves. Our suffering is us, and we need to treat it with kindness and nonviolence. We need to embrace our fear, hatred, anguish, and anger. My dear suffering, I know you are there. I am here for you, and I will take care of you. We stop running from our pain with all our courage and tenderness. We recognize, acknowledge, and identify. And we need that tenderness. So nice that he talks about, he gets outside of his suffering a little bit. When you see your suffering, you get outside of it a little bit. You're watching your suffering. You're not carried away by it. You are more than your suffering. And you say, suffering, I know you there. I know you're there. I can care for you. It's like holding a baby, you know, like Ted, I know you're suffering. You're hurting. You're hurting. Let me care for you. We have to be that tender with ourselves, as tender as we would be with a little baby. So applying the first noble truth to the immediate question, it tells us to be present with that suffering that prevents us from engaging. We don't need to touch the suffering of the entire world. We need to touch the suffering of our own despair, fear, and paralysis as much as you can today. And maybe that's not very much. Maybe it's not at all. Maybe it's just touching the fact that you don't want to touch your suffering. That's good. That's a beginning. It's like when you can't sit, when you can't meditate. You know what you do when you can't meditate? You sit down on the cushion and you say, I don't want to be here. And you get up again. That's good. That's a good start. The second noble truth is that our suffering is caused by our desire. Probably not all of it. There are forces out there in the world that cause us suffering. It doesn't have anything to do with our desire. There's no denying that. But we can control our response to those forces. And wisdom for me and for others too, this may sound familiar to you, comes down to knowing what I can't change and accepting those things. When I can do that, it frees up my mind to work in the realm of the things I can change. Suffering is caused by desire. And in this case, it is a desire that things should be other than what they are. We all lament about things we can't change, which is natural. But at some point, we need to move on. We can't get stuck there with, oh, I wish this was different. So applying the second noble truth to our question, it tells us that the suffering, the paralysis that we might feel is not always something inflicted upon us from the outside. It's something that arises within us. And I say this again without judgment. We're human. There's no fault here, but there's good news here. If we're creating our own suffering, we can change it. We can end our own suffering. And that leads to the third noble truth. The third noble truth, and this is where the hope comes in, this is the Buddha's great message of hope for the world, is that we can end our suffering by ending our desire, or at least we can end the part of it that we've created ourselves. We can change. If we accept the reality of our own suffering and accept that we've created it, we can change that reality. And applying that to our question, we can acknowledge this great hope. We can acknowledge that it is possible to become unstuck and act in a deeply effective way. And we can search inside for a sort of vow, a sort of resolution, a sort of statement to ourselves that we want to do this thing. It may be a wordless vow. It may have words. It may be a little vow. It may be a vow to entertain the notion of making a vow. It may be a pre-vow. It may be asking the question, can I even do this? Do I want to do this? It may be holding the question like a koan. What is a vow? What is a vow to me? And it may become something greater, and you may take it further, maybe very far, but start where you are. Always start where you are. And how do we do this? How do we acknowledge suffering, see that it's caused by our desire, and see that we can end our suffering? Well, that's the fourth noble truth, which tells you how to do this. There is an eightfold path for relieving suffering. And the eightfold path, which many of you have studied in depth, is really great. And I could go through it this morning and talk about how each of the steps applies to our current question. I could talk about how right view is taking in the truth that there is a better way. Right thinking means deciding to do something about it. I could talk about how our speech, actions, and livelihood bear on this issue, how right effort is required, because none of this is easy, and how meditation and mindfulness are essential to resolving this question of how I conduct my inner life in order to be able to act effectively in the world. But because the Eightfold Path is so familiar, I'd like to talk about something else, which is calling in support. And this finds its roots more in the Triple Treasure, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and especially in Sangha. If we're going to do this thing, we need to do it with the support of others. We're going to need to call upon a lot of support. So before you do any of this, before you begin to think about beginning to do something about all of this, call in support. Call in the Buddhas and ancestors. There they are now. There's a reason that during our Saturday service and during our meal chants and during ordinations and initiations and sometimes during weddings and sometimes during funerals, we call in the Buddhas and ancestors. We invoke them. For example, during the meal chant, Maitreya Buddha of future birth, all Buddhas throughout space and time, Lotus of the Wondrous Dharma, Mahayana Sutra, Manjushri Bodhisattva, great wisdom, Samantabhadra Bodhisattva, great activity, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, great compassion, Samantabhadra Bodhisattva, great activity, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Rajna Paramita. And the reason we do this, well, to some folks, we're calling upon entities outside of us to come and help us. But whether we think of these bodhisattvas as actual entities or qualities within ourselves that we're evoking, they remind us of all the beings in the world who have been here to help us. We have the historical Buddha. We have the lineage of teachers going back 2,500 years. We have the network of Buddhist practitioners in the United States and throughout the world. We have our own Sangha. We have our founders, including Katagiri, going back 50 years. We have our families. We have our grandparents. We have our ancestors going back to time immemorial, and our friends and our networks. Call them in. Call them all in. Remind yourself of the tremendous support you have. Remind yourself that you are only one tiny component in a vast, interconnected universe, and that that universe will hold you up. And all you have to do is let it hold you up. So call them in. This could take a long time. There are a lot of them. It's worth it. And also, and this is my second bit of practical advice, talk to someone. Talk to someone about the whole entire deal. Tell them everything, all your fears, all your hesitation, all of your paralysis. Because it's incredible how that simple act of telling someone can change your outlook. I had a dear friend once, something really, really terrible happened to her when she was a young woman. And she told me that she didn't tell anybody about it for months. She kept it to herself for months. And finally, she told someone. And a lot of the heaviness of it, a lot of the suffering just lifted when she told someone about it. It is remarkable how that can work. And this is something I did recently. I called up a friend whom I really respect, and we went for a walk, and we talked about all of our fears together. I put it all out there. Because I've had to work all of this out for myself. How am I going to respond to what's coming? Sickness, old age, and death, the state of the country, the state of the Sangha. How do I respond? So in talking to this person, I had what I would call an emotional turning. I realized it afterwards. And that's what we're looking for here. That's how we operate. We have these emotional turnings. You can't force a change if you're feeling despair or paralysis. You can only invite something in. You can invite an emotional turning. And that comes with talking to a trusted friend, maybe to a teacher, maybe an MZMC teacher, to someone wise who will listen. So when you're ready, call in support, talk to someone, begin to begin, and your inner bodhisattva will emerge. It may be Avalokiteshvara, hearing the cries of the world. It may be Samantabhadra, engaging in organized social action. It may be Manjushri, cutting through delusion, or Maitreya, the Buddha of the future. It may be Jizo, ready to go into hell to rescue others. So now I'd like to answer my own burning question. Which bodhisattva does the world most need right now? The answer is the one that is within you. And that's my talk. So thank you for listening. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And I'd love to hear from others if anyone has anything to say at this point.
I've got a question.
Okay.
Well, first of all, thank you for the talk. I couldn't agree more. And there's a saying that goes that you lead a horse to water, but you can't force it to drink.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that you've worked internally and you have found a state of peace, but your friends and your family are still suffering. And then naturally your desire is to help them in their suffering and somehow end their suffering. But for whatever reason, they can't see it, they're stubborn, they don't see a way out. What do you do with that?
Yeah. Well, you can only do what you can do. And I think often when people are kind of resistant, you know, maybe they don't want to hear it. You feel like there's no way to get through to them. You feel like you could be helpful, but they don't want to hear it. You can't push it too much. You can suggest it. You can watch for an opening. But sometimes we have to just sort of, you know, be exemplars to kind of handle things ourselves in a very upright sort of way as an example, and that's all we can do. And we can hope that people are going to see that and it's going to cause them to open up. So part of the bodhisattva path is sort of accepting there are limits to what I could do and I need to be patient in that way.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyone else? Yes, Barbara.
You spoke about the state of our society and the world. There's a number of main concerns that we hear a lot about: politics, our environment, the economy. There's a major one. It's hard when you look at them, you don't know where to begin. And a lot of times it can cause a lot of anxiety. But what I've found is that you can be overwhelmed by them, or you can just choose one thing. And for each thing that you have a concern for, there is an organization that fights that. So when you're looking for your community, you might look there. And it can be an hour volunteer, it can be a letter to the senator, it can be planting a tree, it can be any level of involvement that you want. It's just that many steps, you take one tiny step. And if we all just take one tiny step towards the thing that we care about, that's what we believe that we want.
Yes. Yeah, that's great. That's great. I agree. And I think probably when you came to that conclusion, that followed some of the kind of inner work and reflection that I'm talking about. You must have engaged in quite a lot of that to kind of get to that point. Yeah, I'll do one thing. I'll take one step, which is nice. Katagiri used to say, just take one step. Just take one step. Thank you.
Thank you for bringing up the talk.
Yeah. Leslie.
Yeah, thank you. Great talk. Thank you very much. I'm thinking about this last week. I had a couple kind of big upheavals that were very positive in the long run, but it caused me some pain. I mean, I had a lot going on with it when it first happened, and I called a friend. And she said, to the therapist, which she ended up hurting, and she said, well, how do you feel about it? And I'm really grateful that I'm in a point in my life that I've done a lot of meditation and self-study and everything. I was able to look at all the emotions I was feeling, because it wasn't just fear or anger or sadness. It was all of those things. And so I kind of just ran through everything that I was feeling about the situation. And it gave me some freedom right away, because, I think Manjushri is my own personal focus in a lot of ways, because cutting through the delusion is a huge thing for me. Because if I can cut through my own delusions, I can see things much more clearly and open things up. So by going through everything, really honestly, this is what I'm feeling. It really lifted a lot from me. And the interesting thing was, that night I had some interaction with the person that this whole thing was centered around, and it was very positive. And the next day, I said, let me respond tomorrow. I said, I also feel this way in a lot of ways. Let me respond tomorrow. And I gave it a nod, and then, which I would have never done in the past. I mean, years ago, I would have immediately gotten into the battle, And the next morning, I had a solution, and I sent it, and it was all wonderful. And I mean, I don't know how this is going to ultimately play out, but I think that it's because I was able to step back, cut through my own illusions about the thing, and really look at it openly. It really changed the whole situation, not just in me, but the situation itself seemed to kind of go with that place. And I look at the other stuff going around that I can't do anything about other than in little ways. And there's where I might bring in, some of the other bodhisattvas and call on that energy when I want to work, for social justice, or when I want to really work with one person and they need compassion more than anything, then I can call on those bodhisattvas. But for me personally, I think that cutting through the delusion is one of the most important things for me able to do all the other things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like a core one. Thank you for the talk.
Thank you. And it sounds like talking to your friend, who happens to be a therapist, was a pretty important part of this process.
Certainly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it wasn't because she gave me a lot of advice. It was that I had a trusted place to really talk about where I was.
Yeah.
It wasn't, I mean, she did give me a little bit, but it wasn't stuff that I didn't know already. I mean, you kind of know a lot of stuff after you've done a lot of the work, but it was that, okay, I'm going to really look at what's going on here. And I had a safe place to do it.
Yeah.
Very receptive, loving place. So, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know why we think we should keep it inside all the time. So, just looking around. Anyone online have a comment? Or a question, perhaps? Anyone else in the room before we go on to other things? Well, I think we have a couple here.
Yeah, David here.
Okay.
This is more of a thinking out loud question. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. Looks like you can't see me though, huh?
I can see you now. There you are.
Okay. I can see you now. It's like I can hear you now, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Sometimes when there's a problem, a person who's hurtful in the world or doing things, you know, I can understand. I try to be skillful. I try to be look for that moment, like you talked about, to intervene. And then I have a family member who sometimes says, you just got to hit him over the head. You just got to be angry with him. You got to be direct. And I can think of some therapists who used to do that too. And they'd say, yeah, half the time it's a mistake, but the other half of the time it really works. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are about, you know, how you decide that. Because I tend to lean towards being a little too skillful sometimes instead of hitting people over the head with, you must stop this.
Yeah.
Hurtful.
Oh, that's an approach to, you know, I wrote a book with a teenager that I was sort of mentoring for a year, and he had all kinds of problems and he was doing all kinds of things. And I, you know, used my usual gentle approach. And I had a friend who said, don't you just want to kind of smack him on the head sometimes? And I don't know, I thought that was really funny. It doesn't sound very funny right now, but yeah, you know, sometimes you do need to be really direct. Sometimes you really need to be firm. Sometimes you need to be to just break through a lot of stuff. How do you decide that? I don't know. It just takes a lot of wisdom, I think, a lot of sensitivity, and kind of weigh the options, is, you know, harm against doing good.
Yes, maybe you'll make a point, and maybe they'll turn around and walk away from you. You can't tell sometimes.
Yeah, you never know. But, you know, you have to try something. You may be wrong, but you have to try something.
Try something.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ted.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go to Davey, and then we'll go to Diana here in the room. Davey.
Yes. So for me, Kuan Yin is the bodhisattva that I want to try to emulate. I try to be mostly present with everybody and be receptive to what's going on in their lives, and trying to find those positive little moments in people's lives to share with them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I see that in you. Diana.
Hi. Thank you so much for your talk. It kind of helps me open up a little bit, because sometimes I feel that if I bring somebody into my suffering, it's like I'm throwing my suffering on them, and I wouldn't want to do that. But then at the same time, like, how am I gentle with myself? How do I have enough compassion with myself to release my suffering and trust that the other person can just be there for me and not take it on?
Mm-hmm.
So I really appreciate your words and how they kind of help me work through my own isolation.
Yeah, good point. If you're going to talk to somebody, it needs to be somebody who's willing to listen. willing to take that on. You can't just inflict that on you. You can't burden folks with that. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. Yes, Benjamin. Yes.
About a little while ago, I went to the Capitol with the group that to support the PR. And I didn't know any of the people that were so and I spent part of the day talking to my legislators. We rallied at the Capitol and chanted and held our signs. And after that day, it was the first time I felt hopeful for a long time. And I feel like a huge part of it was that in COVID, we were all isolated and facing all these problems by ourselves. They feel overwhelming, like there's nothing you can do. But when you get together with Sonia, the Sonia together helps create the hopefulness and working together. So I still appreciate that people that as part of.
Yeah, thank you. Could you folks online hear that? No? Okay, so she was talking about taking part in an Equal Rights Amendment event, talking to legislators and how helpful that was in terms of just feeling hope and feeling better being involved in that action. Thank you. Ginny. It was the people. It was the other people there together, a new Sangha, you said. Yeah. Ginny.
Thank you for the talk, Ted. I love this concept of like the bodhisattvas within and kind of calling up these different aspects of ourselves that may be more present. You know, one particular archetype might be someone that speaks more to us than another or that comes up more naturally for us. One thing that I came across recently, and it might take me a minute to connect that to your talk, so be fair with me. One thing that I heard recently that was impactful for me was around metta practice, and where we, when we're in meditation, we call up ourselves and others, and you know, wishing people wellness and health and love and safety. And often part of that practice is at one point bringing to mind somebody that we have some difficulty with, or maybe even antipathy for. And I have a particular, I don't have a lot of enemies like in my life that I think of that way, but there is one individual that I routinely call up when I'm doing this practice. Mm-hmm. And I was really for a while like, wow, I'm really great at metta, because I sit here and I think about this person and I'm like, yeah, I can really see how things would be better if this person could experience wellness. And then I was at a retreat recently where the teacher talked about the near enemy of compassion, something that looks like compassion, but that isn't really. And this is like compassion with an agenda. I want you to be well so that something else will happen. And I realized that's a trap that I easily fall into. And I was thinking about this kind of in the personal realm, and some of the questions and comments that are coming up this morning that comes up for me too, with people I'm close with, in my family, for example, who I can see are suffering and I want them to be well, but also like, there's this part of me that's like, well, I could fix you. If only you could listen to me making the very intelligent point about how you're clearly harming yourself, then you would be better. And so bringing it back to your talk, one thing that was really impactful for me was this part, which we've heard before, but this part of, it starts with touching the suffering. Mm-hmm. And that's true for my own suffering. It starts with being able to see it and be with it and acknowledge it and see that it's there. And I think that's the part that is easy to skip with others, with a family member I'm thinking of right now, it's easy to skip over the I'm here with you in your suffering and it's real and I see it. It's easy to skip past that and be like, I want to fix it. And
yeah.
And so I think there's something really powerful. I'm not saying I know how to do that. It's hard. It's painful, I think, to, especially with people we love and we're close to just kind of be there and not try to fix or control the suffering that is going on with the other person. So I appreciate that part.
Yeah. If you're not in touch with your own suffering, you may not understand how your own suffering is influencing the way you relate to people who you're trying to help. And you may not help them very skillfully, right?
Yeah.
Kind of restating what you said.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's probably a good place to stop. May the merit of this help all beings. And we can turn this over to our esteemed Doan Joe.